Hello, it's Thursday, the 21st of October. I'm Richard Spur for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. As the Queen reluctantly steps back from an official trip to Northern Ireland to safeguard her health, is the 95-year-old monarch under undue pressure to perform public duties? Are smartphones hampering young children's ability to learn to read? You'll get the latest from the city. How the legacy of Jurassic Park has inspired a new generation of dinosaur artwork. But first, has the government got it wrong by not reintroducing COVID restrictions in the wake of ever higher rates of infection? COVID cases are rising in the UK, and it's expected that cases could surge to 100,000 a day. Well, doctors have urged the government to implement Plan B, a return of face masks, working from home, and COVID passports for nightclubs and events. Health Secretary Sajid Javid has said that the pressure on the NHS is sustainable and that restrictions are unnecessary at this time. Well, I'm joined now by Linda Bold, Professor of Public Health at the University of Edinburgh. Linda, has the government got it right on this?
I think many in the public health community would feel, as usual, that it's better to take early action. And actually, Plan B, with the issue, if we just set aside the issue of vaccine certification for a moment, the key elements of Plan B, mandating face coverings, encouraging more people to work from home where appropriate for the sector, are really very low-level public health interventions. I think it would be wiser to do those now. On certification already introduced here in Scotland for certain venues and about to be in Wales, I know there are big debates about that, but many, many countries have done that. So I don't think this is not a lockdown. These are low-level measures.
How dangerous for the government is this almost rebellion, really, by the BMA and others in the healthcare sector?
I think it is problematic. I mean, to say that the NHS can cope is fair enough, but it depends where you are in the country. And the BMA and others will be thinking about the hospitals who really are under strain now, where many elective procedures are cancelled. Research is not happening. I've seen that, including amongst colleagues in England and elsewhere in the UK, where studies have to be stopped because the NHS can't accommodate them. That will have consequences for the future. That's back to the earlier days of the pandemic. So I think it is concerning that there's not consensus from the clinical community as well about the current path of action.
If the government doesn't bring in more mandatory measures, what will happen, do you think, to the NHS this winter?
I think it's already under severe pressure. The army has been asked to assist in some parts of the country, not just with driving ambulances, but other things as well. I'm genuinely worried about that. And it's not just an effect of COVID. It's the legacy also of the backlog of cases we're dealing with, the many cancer, diabetes and other patients who are not able to be treated and are getting seen later, so they're sicker. And also the fact that we have other respiratory viruses, which are now like RSV, which is causing challenges now for pediatrics, and potentially influenza and other things. So I think it is going to be an extremely difficult winter. I've not spoken to a single clinician who's not said they're very concerned about this winter.
We often talk about the tightrope that the government has to tread when it comes to the economy and the balance between clinical safety for members of the public. What do you think they should be implementing now?
Well, I would like to see those low-level measures applied across the UK. I certainly think asking people to wear face coverings and saying it's required in the way it was before is pretty straightforward. I'm not sure why that has become politicised. I think that's deeply unfortunate. I think employers have a responsibility as well. If their employees can work from home, that should be the strategy. I know that's not possible everywhere. And then also, I think we just need to be really putting a lot of effort into communication around the vaccines and adequately resourcing the whole range of vaccines. It's not just COVID that now need to be delivered, particularly the influenza campaign, making sure the NHS is able to do that. And that means having adequate levels of staffing and making a commitment to sustain those.
Why do you think the government is dragging its heels when it comes to bringing back measures?
I think they are. I think it varies in different parts of the UK, but I think at UK level, there was this sort of social contract, wasn't there? Actually, this is relevant everywhere, between the population and the government, that if you came forward for vaccines, this was our route out of the pandemic. And people have done that in the millions. And we're still in a difficult period. So I think it's just trying to weigh up the difficult decisions they have to make. And at UK level, they've come down on one side, which is to delay. And I do think there are worries about that.
When it comes to the projections for the increase in rates of infection, of course, of death, sadly, it is a very
worrying future for us? And I mean, how do you feel that, you know, the government should be addressing that? Another lockdown possibly before Christmas?
Well, actually, I think I really want to stay away from that L word. I think there are other things that we can do. Ventilation, face coverings, you know, and thinking about where people are working, etc., encouraging people not to pile onto public transport. But importantly, let's just keep the focus on vaccines and treatment as well, because they are still the key component. They're not the only component, but they're a key component. And there are a couple of things I would say. The first thing is, let's really get this booster campaign up and running and working at scale. But secondly, and actually equally importantly, we really need to accelerate the rollout of the vaccines to young people. It's clear that's where the reservoir of infection is happening. We've seen that in the teenagers around the country. And, you know, the UK has been very late to the table with that vaccine offer. And finally, on those younger age groups, we need advice from the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation on second doses for our young people, just the same as in many other countries. I think many, many of us just don't understand why that's not forthcoming.
And in recent weeks, I've been in various countries in Europe, mainly in southern Europe, and I noticed that mask wearing and hand sanitising, people were, you know, really rather meticulous about it. That certainly isn't the case if you go around in the UK at the moment. And I suspect that people have lost their appetite for, you know, buying into the whole protocol that we hitherto had to conform to when it comes to keeping ourselves and others safe. What would you say to members of the public about just how they ought to conduct themselves in the future weeks and months?
Well, I would say that we've been asked to take more responsibility, and I think it still needs to be a partnership between the state and the population. But there's a simple thing that we can all do, is wear a mask indoors when we're not meeting up with people that we don't, who are not in our household. You know, I would ask everyone to do that, to do it carefully and think about others. And then secondly, for the 5 million people who haven't yet had a vaccine, I think it's very important that they come forward. These are things that we can do for ourselves and for our communities. We've done many things for our communities throughout this pandemic. We need to continue to do that, you know, while living in a society that is largely open. And I think the more vaccine coverage we have, and the treatments as well, are going to be really important. I think that will allow us to look ahead with more confidence.
Many thanks for your time. That was Linda Bold, Professor of Public Health at the University of Edinburgh. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The Queen made headlines this week by cancelling a trip to Northern Ireland under doctor's orders, and has recently been seen using a walking stick for support on visits. She'll host world leaders at the COP26 Environment Conference next month. And at 95 years old, the question is, are we asking too much of her? Well, I'm joined now by Victoria Murphy, who's the royal author and a writer for Town and Country. How significant is this step back from a public duty, Victoria?
Well, I think what we've seen this week is an example of something that's been going on really for the last 10 years or so, these kind of gradual concessions to the Queen's age that she can't do what did 10, even 5 years ago. We've seen over the past 10 years her modify her timetable. She no longer does any long-haul travel. She hasn't laid the wreath at the cenotaph for a number of years, for example. She doesn't wear the imperial state crown for the state opening of Parliament. So we have seen these concessions, and this is an example of something that we may see happen more now, because I think there is an appreciation that there has to be an understanding that if the doctor says you need to take a step back, it's best not to do this, that she does need to listen to that.
Are we aware of any specific medical condition that the Queen may be suffering from?
We're not aware of anything. I mean, they're very reluctant to go into details about the royal family's medical condition. We have been advised that it's not COVID related, and I think it was very important for them to make that point, because of course at this time that's the first thing that everyone thinks of and what people want to know. So for them to sort of rule that out publicly was probably quite important. But generally we don't get specific details of information about anything that the royals may or may not be suffering from, unless it's absolutely necessary. So we haven't been given any information, but the tone of the statement was, you know, talking about her being in good spirits. I thought it was very interesting that they made a point of saying that she's reluctantly accepted this advice and that she was disappointed. Now, that language wasn't really necessary in order to convey the facts, but I think it's very clear that this was not her choice, not her preferred option, and she clearly wanted that to be communicated.
whatever your views about royalty or republicanism, I mean, this is a stoic and robust woman, you know, the longest reigning monarch in history. And my goodness, she's put in some air miles for us over the years, hasn't she?
Well, I think that's the thing. And I think also what it's important to point out is that nothing is being asked of her that she does not want to do herself. This is coming from her. You know, she made that speech when she was 21, that very famous speech promising to devote her whole life to duty. And, you know, I've been pointed to that speech by palace aides over the years when this comes up, will she ever abdicate? And they're the words that you're pointed to. And she still, I think, holds that philosophy very, very strongly. And we've seen that. We've really seen that in the last 10 years. And I think particularly in the last couple of years as well, when there's been a real opportunity, I think, for her to do less if she'd wanted to. We've had the pandemic, we've had Prince Philip's death. And around that time, a lot of people were saying, now that he's not here, will she do even less? But then we've seen her come out in these past couple of weeks, and she signed off this program, which included huge numbers of trips around the whole of the UK, a very, very busy programme, and clearly she wanted to do that.
And whilst the Terrible Two have done a bunk to America, there are still, you know, there's Prince William, there's Prince Charles, Camilla, of course, you know, all in good health, presumably able to take up duties if the Queen can't these days make them.
That's true, although I think with something like Northern Ireland, having somebody else step in at a late stage was clearly not going to be possible, and that's why it didn't happen. But we are seeing more now her do engagements alongside other members of the royal family. So often she'll be accompanied by another family member. It will be a joint engagement. And from time to time, we do see them directly step in for her. I mean, of course, Prince Charles lays the nation's wreath at the cenotaph now. And we've seen on all overseas visits in the last few years, other members of the royal family represent the Queen. So that's something that's certainly going to continue. But it does really feel that the mood music coming from her is that she wants to do as much as is absolutely possible. And it's only things like medical advice that will stop her from doing that.
Well, indeed. But do you think that there is an onus perhaps on government and on the civil service to lighten the load on a woman who, you know, is 95 years old?
Well, except I don't think that there's any pressure coming from them. You know, I mean, you have to remember the Queen is head of state in 15 countries outside of the UK, and she is probably never going to go to any of those countries. And we're not hearing sort of mood music coming from places such as Australia and Canada that for that reason they don't want her to be head of state anymore. I think there's such a huge appreciation for what she has done over the large number of years that she has been able to do everything, and all of the years that she's put that work in and built that relationship, that there's a huge amount of credit there if she wasn't able to do things in person. And we've seen whenever she's not been able to do anything, even in the UK, I've never felt that the mood has been, oh, she should be doing that, or why isn't she doing that? I feel there's a real appreciation from all angles that, of course, there's an understanding when she can't do things. So I think it's coming from her. I think she wants to be doing as much as she can.
And just finally, Victoria, I know that information is limited, as it always is from the palace, but can we expect the Queen to be at the COP26 Environment Conference next month?
Well, she's very much still scheduled to go. And I think that's definitely going to be something that she will want to do if she can. We wouldn't expect to find out this early if that had been ruled out or not. That's the next engagement that had been publicly announced, but whether or not we might even see her in a slightly more reduced capacity before then, maybe on a Zoom call or something like that next week, we'll have to see. But there's certainly every intention at this stage, as far as I understand, for her to be there as expected.
Victoria, many thanks for taking the time. That was Victoria Murphy, royal author and writer for Town and Country. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. Parents are being told that mobile phones should be kept out of toddlers' hands, as a new report says that smartphones can distract children and make it harder for them to learn to read. Well, I'm joined now by parenting coach Sue Atkins. Sue, I saw a young lad, must have been, I don't know, about 3 years old, on a train the other day, and his mum handed him a picture book, you know, an old-fashioned picture book made of paper, made of card. And I noticed he was trying to expand the images of the animals with his fingers on the book. Now, on the one hand, I thought it was quite funny, but on the other hand, quite worrying.
Well, I've seen that before, yes. I mean, technology, you know, it's done such a lot to make our lives easier and more efficient. Of course it has. But as a parent, you ought to be kind of concerned about the impact that the device, you know, such as smartphones and mobile phones and all of that, can have on your child. Because, you know, it's very commonplace. I call them electric babysitters, you know, because kids just are handed the phone in restaurants. I've seen that when I've been out and about with my own family. You know, two-year-old's been given the phone and the baby been given, a device. And it's not really good for them. You know, there's a whole host of reasons why not. And I'm not a killjoy, but certainly toddlers and young children, it's not a good idea.
I remember when I was young and I had an even younger brother who was a toddler, and if he was being, not that he was very often, but, you know, a little bit demanding, we would sit him in front of Postman Pat or Fireman Sam. I'm showing my age here in my generation. and that would do the trick. Is this any different?
Well, it's very passive. And, of course, what happens with children is it's also, you know, very zingy, colourful, fast-acting. It can become quite addictive. You know, kids don't like it when you take them off it because life isn't quite so exciting when you're kind of walking along or, you know, just looking at a book. And, it limits their creative minds. Small children should be out exploring and using all their senses, balancing, climbing, you know, discovering. And, of course, what you're setting that all up is, you know, a possible addiction to it later on, because you think it's harmless now because they're on it just for a while, but also it can cause problems with sleep, you know, and it doesn't really give children time to sort of slow down. Their brains get very buzzy, and certainly if you do it at night, the blue light can really set them off. Instead of giving, you know, you don't give them the mobile to have a story on it, because that then sort of triggers them to be wide awake rather than getting them relaxed.
How serious is this worry? And I suspect it is quite a concern that actually the ability to read and write is going to be hampered by young children's reliance on these digital devices.
Yeah, and I'm a former deputy head, and of course now I write lots of books around parenting and stuff for kids, but it also can have a negative impact on a child's mental health as well. And, you know, you think by giving them an educational app that that's doing the trick, but there is nothing quite like jumping up on your lap and being read a story to. You know, you're bonding, you're looking at the pictures, you're developing their vocabulary. All sorts of things are happening when you're doing that kind of thing, or even just talking with your children when you're in a restaurant or walking along the road. You know, discovering. I remember my first book I wrote was called Looking Under Stones and Finding Fairies, because it was based on walking down the road with my own toddler, Will, sort of chatting about all sorts of things that we were looking at as we were toddling along, you know, down the road.
I think you're absolutely right, Sue. I remember that, you know, really the best part of the day was, you know, when I went to bed as a youngster and my mum, usually my mum or maybe my grandmother, would sit on the bed and read me a story, and you become beguiled and you become transfixed. And as you say, it was an incredible bonding moment. And I just fear that we are losing these crucial intersections between parents or grandparents and children, because they're simply being left with, you know, digital hardware.
Absolutely. And I've still got wonderful memories of my dad telling stories to me, and even telling my own children, his grandchildren. You know, in the end, he ran out of true stories and he was calling them true lies because he was making up the stories. But they've still got very, very fond memories of being read to and made up stories. And it's such a joy, you know.
My wonderful grandmother on my dad's side, well, both of my grandmothers were wonderful, but she used to make up stories. And it was only years later that I mean, they'd go on for half an hour or so, that I realised that she was making them up ad hoc every single time. And she must have told me hundreds of them. And she was making them up off the top of her head. I mean, you can't buy that, can you?
It's just wonderful to hear that, isn't it? Absolutely wonderful. They're what I call magic moments. And you don't really get magic moments from a mobile phone, to be really honest.
No, you don't. You absolutely don't. Just finally, what advice would you give to parents about, if you like, rationing the use of this hardware for young children?
Yeah, I'm all about balance. I don't think you ban anything in life particularly, although there are loads of pieces of research, certainly the American Paediatric Society, around don't give a child under two a mobile phone. So if you can, ration that. Play, talk, sing, do all sorts of real things with your very, very young children. And then as they grow up, they, you know, you have to go with the times. You don't ban it all the time, because that makes it more interesting. And then they're different from their friends. But certainly be what I call a kind of a media mentor to your children, particularly as they grow and become into teenagers and things. They need guidance from you, and that's our job, really.
I think you have some very sound advice there. Many thanks for taking the time, Sue. That was parenting coach Sue Atkins. Now it's time for our regular city update with Ruth Sunderland, business editor at the Daily Mail. And I want to talk today, if we can, Ruth, a little bit about government borrowing, because it is an essential element in the way that we are now going forward fiscally, isn't it?
It really is. And today, Richard, we've had some figures for government borrowing. Now, on the face of it, they're mildly encouraging because government borrowing actually fell a little bit in September compared with a year earlier. So it came in at 21.8 billion, and that was 7 billion quid less than it was in September 2020. Now, before we start letting off the firecrackers and getting out the bunting, it's still actually pretty bad. It's the second highest for September since monthly records began, and it's well above where it was before the pandemic. So quite rightly, I think we've gone out, I mean, the Treasury really on behalf of taxpayers has gone out and borrowed a lot of money, 320 billion nearly last year, to support businesses and families during the pandemic. But the question is, you know, when are we going to pay that back? Who's going to pick up the tab for it all? How long can it go on? We can't let it become a completely unsustainable. That borrowing's got to come down. At the moment, the money markets are quite keen on UK government debt, which is just as well, really. But if they lose faith in our credibility, if they lose the belief that we could repay it, that we're on course to do that, then that could all change quite quickly. So Rishi, in his budget next week, he's on a very tricky wicket, really. You know, he's got to keep a lid on borrowing, a lid on spending, and he's got to do that without squashing confidence and without crushing the recovery. So it's quite a tough task in front of him. One of the most significant budgets, I would say, of recent years, Richard.
I mean, I know it's difficult to forecast, but how do you suspect, given what we know about the current Chancellor, that he's going to approach this, as you quite rightly say, tightrope act?
I think that Rishi is quite keen to show that he has absolutely no intention of letting borrowing run out of control. I don't think he'll come on too strongly with the hair shirt at this point, but I think he'll want to send out very strong messages that, you know, this has been an emergency and not a way of life. So he'll want to make that very, very clear. And it's important that he does, because as we've seen, you know, we've had a lot of industries coming out with their hands out. He'll be besieged by his colleagues in charge of government departments because there's a spending review on the same day as the budget, wanting more money. You know, it's all going to be wanting more. And he's going to want to send out a very, very strong message. I think he'll probably do that by restating the fiscal rules. Now, fiscal rules are there to basically to keep governments in line on spending and borrowing and make sure it's sustainable. And they were suspended during the pandemic. I think he'll probably bring those back in. They might be different from what they were pre-pandemic, but I think he'll restore those fiscal rules, and they'll set out targets for limiting borrowing and limiting spending. And I think that will just tell everybody, you know, look, here I am, Rishi, and I'm serious, that you can't get carried away with free spending and debt. Because after all, they're not really conservative values, are they? You know, the core Tory values are around debt discipline and fiscal discipline. And I think he'll want to sort of get right back into that zone as much as he possibly can.
Ruth, it's always good to have your insight. Many thanks as ever. That was Ruth Sunderland, business editor at the Daily Mail. If you want to, get in touch. Tweet us at MailPlus. In 1993, dinosaurs took to the big screen in Jurassic Park. But Jack Horner, inspiration for Sam Neill's character in Jurassic Park and a technical advisor on the film, has created a series of dinosaur images, which he says show what the creatures really looked like. While the images are being sold as digital artworks, NFTs, or non-fungible tokens, secured by blockchain to benefit the Horner Science Group. And Jack Horner joins me now. Jack, welcome. And just first of all, what was it like for you to see, or indeed to read, the translation of your character in Jurassic Park?
Michael Crichton read a book that I wrote concerning dinosaur behavior, and he took my character and created Alan Grant. I can't say that the portrayal in the movie and myself are not that similar, but the so-called discoveries are.
But it was the most enormous hit, wasn't it? I mean, I remember as a young boy going to see it at the cinema, and it was like nothing we'd ever seen before. I mean, it really took the world by storm.
Yes, it did. It was fun to work on. It was fun to work with Steven Spielberg as the advisor, and it was 1993, and our ideas of dinosaurs have changed considerably since then.
You clearly have an enormous passion for what you do. Just talk a little bit about the state of paleontology at the moment. I mean, are we still finding out stuff that we hitherto never knew about?
Absolutely. We're finding new dinosaurs all the time, rethinking hypotheses that we've, that long-held hypotheses. And as we continue to learn, we need to change. And one of the, changes that we've known for even, when Jurassic Park was made, there were certain technical difficulties that couldn't be overcome to make dinosaurs as realistic as even we knew they were then. One was, we knew that velociraptors should have feathers, but technically couldn't really be done for Jurassic Park. We also knew that dinosaurs should be more colorful, and Stephen wasn't too fond, he wasn't too big on trying to make them colorful because he thought they wouldn't be scary enough.
in this age of mass digital technology and all the stuff that's available online, I just wonder whether those, real thrills that young children used to experience about, let's say, dinosaurs or about space travel, whether that's waned slightly. Do you think there still is the appetite and the intrigue for dinosaurs and everything to do with them amongst younger people?
Yes. 6 to 8 year old kids just absolutely adore dinosaurs, like many of the rest of us. I mean, I haven't seen any of it waning at all. Every new generation just loves dinosaurs.
And just finally, just talk a little bit about this new project and these images, what they are, the inspiration for them, and how we can consume them.
Well, one of the things that sort of bothered me, like I said, there were technical difficulties in Jurassic Park, and besides that, Stephen wasn't too thrilled about making colorful dinosaurs, but we know that dinosaurs gave rise to birds. We know that birds are dinosaurs, and yet, a lot of the renditions of dinosaurs are just, reptilian looking rather than bird-like. And the cool thing about dinosaurs is there's a lot of them that are just, have these huge displays. Their shields and their spikes and their plates and their horns, all of these things, we realize that, they're not defense mechanisms. They're not aggressive adaptation. They're display features, things that birds do in feathers now. These big, huge displays on Triceratops. I mean, to make them just sort of a dull gray is just a horrible thing to do. And we know that Triceratops' skull was covered with some hard keratin-like substance, and birds have hard keratin covering their beaks and oftentimes their bony structures on their heads, and they're colorful. They're vividly colored. So there's no reason not to at least, hypothesize that dinosaurs had very similar structures and that they were vividly colored as well. And that is what I'm trying to get across. Many ways, Steven Spielberg presented his dinosaurs in a movie, and I can't make a movie, so.
And just finally, Jack, where can we get hold of these images?
Well, they're being presented today as NFTs, 10 of them, and they're coming out in a variety of ways. Some of them will be auctioned. Some will have set prices, and some of them are made relatively cheap. I mean, they will be easy to get.
It's been great to talk to you, great to catch up with you, and to explore the legacy of Jurassic Park. That was Jack Horner, world-renowned paleontologist. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. Good night.